This is Jeff Blankford with the April 24th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. The understandable disgust of Big D Democrats with Donald Trump and their obsession with Russia's Vladimir Putin and Julian Assange that has roiled the nation's political water since the 2016 presidential election and produced the Mueller report appears to be far from over. To listen to politicians on both sides of the aisle in Washington, it's almost certainly going to be with us up to the 2020 election, and if the Democrats in their passion play their cards wrong, the nation and the world might be facing another 4 years of Donald Trump. At the same time, the efforts by the Trump administration, most visible through pronouncements by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to effectively destroy the Iranian economy in hopes of overthrowing that government through provoking an internal uprising and provide an excuse for intervening militarily, have been escalating. Yet they haven't drawn anything like the attention from the media, the political class, or the public that greeted the Mueller report, despite being, I will argue, unquestionably more important. Both of these subjects are what I hope to be discussing with investigative reporter, journalist, Gareth Porter, 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned. One of the things that I have found most disturbing in the Mueller report and with the Big D Democrats, who have fetishized it, is their obvious belief that it would have been better if Democratic voters had never learned how the Democratic Party hierarchy had sabotaged the campaign of Senator Bernie Sanders on Hillary Clinton's behalf. It was not only as a result of WikiLeaks' release of the emails of the Democratic National Committee and later of Clinton campaign chair John Podesta that their unconscionable and intentional interference in the 2016 Democratic primaries came to light, which, as the Washington Post Aaron Blake wrote at the time, quote, suggests the committee was actively trying to undermine Sanders' presidential campaign and belie the National Party's commitment to stated neutrality. The only penalty for the main culprit, Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a close Clinton confidant, was that she had to step down from her post as DNC chair while retaining her place in Clinton's entourage and a prominent figure in Democrat Party politics. Already reported the Washington Post, how could they know at the time? The Clinton campaign and several cybersecurity experts said the leak was a political ploy carried out by the Russian government to aid in the election of Trump, end quote. But no one could deny the emails and the documents they contained were not authentic. I read one that I had earlier missed just this past Monday, which I'm going to share with you, in an article entitled Elevating Trump by Rich Moser and Counterpunch, published October 11th, 2016, a month before the election, which cited a link to an email message to the staff on John Podesta's computer dated April 23, 2015, containing an agenda for a meeting of the Democratic National Committee the following day, which is 4 years ago today. That was before, mark you, before Trump had formally announced his candidacy, but the meeting agenda was focused on pushing for the Republicans who nominate the most far-right candidate possible. The three leading choices were Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, and Ben Carson. The new evidence provided by WikiLeaks Podesta's files, wrote Richard Moser on Counterpunch back 2015, makes a convincing case that the Clinton team wanted extreme Republicans as the best possible opponents. The proof of that was obvious from the following quotes in that memo describing the Clinton campaign strategy. Quote, force all Republican candidates to lock themselves into extreme conservative positions that will hurt them in a general election. The variety of candidates is a positive here, and many of the lesser known can serve as a cudgel to move the more established candidates further to the right. In this scenario, it goes on, we don't want to marginalize the candidates, but make them more Pied Piper candidates who actually represent the mainstream Republican Party. Pied Piper candidates include, but aren't limited to, Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, Ben Carson. We need to be elevating the Pied Piper candidate, said the email from, quote, Mastor at HillaryClinton.com, so that they are leaders of the pack and tell the press to take them seriously, end quote. You'll recall, as does Moser and Counterpunch, that for months the mass media was quite comfortable broadcasting Trump's bigotry. I always wondered, he wrote, Why media giants so deeply committed to the Clinton machine, big donors to the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton campaign alike, lavish so much attention and so many resources on Trump. They are driven by the same desire to maximize profit as other corporations, true, he notes, but it still seems like there were other stories that could sell soap. The New York Times has estimated that $2 billion worth of free media coverage was given to Trump. Half that would be astounding, Moser wrote. Disasters like the election of 2016 have an overabundance of causes, he concedes. But the Democrats' desire to elevate Trump was part of the potion. And the media followed direction with gusto, end quote. That's from Elevating Trump by Rich Moser and Counterpunch from October 11, 2015. And you can find the entire article online. By an extraordinary coincidence, around the very time that meeting took place, the Washington Post reported that Bill Clinton was urging his golfing buddy, Donald Trump, to become more active in Republican Party politics. Something to think about, no? Well, for doing that, for providing the WikiLeaks with emails with cables from the Iraq War, Manning has done far more prison time than all those who perpetrated that unforgivable disaster combined, and she still is in prison for refusing to testify against Assange at a grand jury lynching in Virginia. Meanwhile, Assange sits in solitary confinement in a maximum security London prison, awaiting likely extradition to the U.S. As to why the alleged cooperation with Russian hackers was not part of the government's charges against Assange, we have to turn to someone from the right, Andrew McCarthy, an editor at the National Review. Why hasn't Assange been indicted for criminal collusion with the Kremlin, he asked in the April 13th issue under the title, Why Isn't Assange Charged with Collusion with Russia? The same hacking conspiracy for which Mueller indicted the Russian operatives with whom Mueller says Assange cooperated. The same conspiracy for which the President of the United States, though not guilty, was under the FBI's microscope for nearly 3 years. Well, the most striking thing about the Assange indictment that the Justice Department did file, McCarthy notes, is how thin it is and how tenuous. Leaping years backward, ignoring collusion with Russia, quote-unquote, prosecutors allege a single cyber theft count, a conspiracy between Assange and then Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, to steal U.S. defense secrets, end quote. This lone charge, he asserts, is punishable by as little as no jail time and a maximum sentence of just 5 years imprisonment, considerably less than the 7 years Assange spent holed up in Ecuador's London embassy to avoid prosecution. After a lengthy breaking down of the Mueller report and the claims of Russian hacking, which he does not contest, he surmises that if the Justice Department had indicted Assange for collusion, Mueller's Russian hacking indictment would no longer stand unchallenged. Assange, he says, would deny that Russia is behind the hacking, and prosecutors would have to try to prove it using hard, admissible courtroom proof, not top-secret sources who cannot be called as witnesses without blowing their cover, or other information that might be reliable enough to support an intelligence finding but would be inadmissible under courtroom due process standards. If the prosecutors, he writes, were unable to establish Russia's guilt to a jury's satisfaction, it would be a tremendous propaganda victory for the Kremlin, even if, as I believe, Russia is actually guilty. That's McCarthy, not me. He goes on, this is part of why it was a mistake to indict the Russian intelligence officers. An indictment is never an authoritative statement. It's just an allegation. It proves nothing. Because they don't have to surrender their officials for an American trial, an indictment is a pointless gesture. But now, writes McCarthy, having with great fanfare filed charges against Russia that implicate Assange, the government shrinks from lodging these same charges against Assange, who, unlike the indicted Russian officials, writes McCarthy, may be in a position to put the government to its burden of proof. This just makes Mueller's indictment of Russia look more like a publicity stunt than a serious allegation. So writes McCarthy, if the government is afraid to try the allegations against Russia in court, people will naturally suspect the allegations are hype. End quote. National Review's Andrew McCarthy. And that's something I and former guests of mine have assumed from the beginning. Now, shifting to Iran, Following on the heels of declaring the Iran Revolutionary Guards to be a terrorist organization, despite opposition from the Pentagon and the CIA, because of the danger in which it would place U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria, which I reported on my last program, Secretary of State and former Tea Party stalwart Mike Pompeo has just repeated Washington's demand to the nations of the world that the United States will not allow them to buy Iranian oil, the lifeblood of that country's economy, and that the eight countries that had been given a waiver by the U.S. to continue purchasing Iran's oil to meet their respective countries' energy needs will no longer be allowed to do so after May 2nd, when the waiver expires. The eight countries in Imperial Washington insists must bow to its will or face U.S. sanctions are China and India, two of the world's largest economies, plus Turkey, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Italy, and Greece. The smaller countries reportedly have been slowly shifting to other sources, but that is not feasible for China or India, nor likely Turkey. While the Indian government has remained silent up to now what it will do, and experts there are saying it will create an economic crisis that the country can ill afford, China has told Washington that it is not about to abide by U.S. dictates. China consistently opposes U.S. unilateral sanctions, said Zhang Shuang, a Chinese foreign military ministry spokesman. The Chinese government, he says, is committed to protecting the legitimate rights and interests of Chinese enterprises, end quote. There is concern in global economic circles about what effect the U.S. crackdown will have on the price of gasoline, which is expected to go up dramatically, as you see it already has. But the more serious consequences are facing the government of Iran and its population, who are being economically squeezed by the Trump administration, which, on this issue, as on all others in the region, is following not that of corporate America, which would like to do business with Iran, but of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Trump's most prominent financial backer, Israeli firster mega-billionaire Sheldon Adelson, who is responsible for the appointment by Trump of neocon fanatic John Bolton as National Security Advisor and Pompeo to replace H.R. McMaster and Rex Tillerson, whose support for Israel was less than 100%. And do not for a moment think that Trump's turning over American Middle East policy to Netanyahu is not appreciated. Thanks to his very public support for the Israeli prime minister in the recent election, and where polls there are shown to be more popular than Netanyahu, Trump's recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the Syrian Golan Heights on the eve of the election will result in a new town being named after him on the Golan Heights, which would be called Kiryat Trump. That's what Netanyahu announced yesterday. I am waiting for someone in Washington, on or in the media, to call for a special counsel to investigate a president who has turned over his foreign policy to the head of a foreign power and done so in a very public way. But given the inordinate power of Israel and its friends over virtually everything that moves in Washington, we know that's not about to happen. Even if the undeclared economic war in Iran, on Israel's behalf, turns into a shooting war that will be far more devastating for the region and the planet than what the U.S. did, arguably on Israel's behalf, in Iraq. There is a certain point we can expect that Iran will argue that it can no longer accept being squeezed to death by what it calls the Great Satan on behalf of what it labels Israel, the Little Satan. And there are already stories appearing on the internet asserting that the U.S. will create a false flag incident like the fabricated Gulf of Tonkin attack, which was used to justify Lyndon Johnson's massive escalation of the Vietnam War. Such a false flag attack to be blamed on Iran was actually suggested in a talk several years ago by Patrick Clausen of the APAC spawn pro-Israel Washington think tank, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which you can find online and which I played for you on a previous program. That we may be getting close to a shooting war with Iran was more than hinted at when, according to the Times of Israel, an Iranian naval commander threatened on Monday to close the strategic Strait of Hormuz, which, located at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, is crucial to global energy supplies, with about a third of all oil traded at sea passing through it. Iran regularly holds maneuvers in the strait, which at its narrowest point is 21 miles wide, in the waters between Iran and Oman. If we are banned from using it, we will close it, General Ali Reza Tangsiri, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Navy, was quoted as saying by the semi-official Iranian Tasnim news agency. Well, such threats have been made before, and skirmishes have occurred between the U.S. and Iran in the Straits, but never has there been an administration so likely to turn one into a full-scale war. Finally, a brief comment on Israel's election of April 9th from Robert Fisk, the Beirut-based dean of Middle East correspondence. So now, writes Fisk, so now I guess we've all run out of excuses. Bibi Netanyahu's Israel will not be a new and more right-wing Israel. It's been that for a long time. It's the propaganda that's going to fall to bits. The only democracy in the Middle East? Give me a break, writes Fisk. I think Israel now looks much more like its Arab neighbors. It dominates its own Arab minority, and its new prime minister has promised to annex much of the territory legally belonging to their fellow Palestinian Arabs, the very colonies built on lands which have already been stolen for the majority Jewish population in Israel. It bombards and threatens its neighbors, jails Palestinian political prisoners on spurious grounds, and rules well over 2 million Arab Palestinians with killer police squads, extrajudicial executions, torture, and paid spies. Now that the Israelis voted Netanyahu and his outrageous party allies back into power, writes Fisk, they too have sacrificed their souls to Bibi. Not maybe they're bloody, writes, because even Bibi knows that long and painful wars are not what Israelis have voted for. Short and painless ones for Israel are okay. It's the Arabs who must bear the pain. End quote. Well, that's an excerpt from Robert Fisk's commentary on the Israeli elections you could find on the Independent News site, entitled No More Excuses, Israeli Voters Have Chosen a Country That Will Mirror the Brutal Regimes of Its Arab Neighbors. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.